Welcome, Weekend Warriors. So excited. But again, I don't do this alone. I make teams in the office, teams in the operating room. I may get all the credit, but the nurses and the angels from above. And the angels today, like every Saturday, the great Rebecca Womble, Steve Paulette, and both Alan and Jared Abrams in the studio. I got a whole audience here today. It's fantastic. We're talking about the Renaissance. But what does the Renaissance mean? Nobody knows it better than my next guest, the great Robin Trento. Robin, thanks so much for making time.
Welcome. It's always fun to talk with you.
So teach us what the Renaissance means. What the principles that I remember that revolutionized the world of art, just like Muhammad Ali, he was a fighter. But everything we do in life is fight. We fight in the kitchen. We fight to fight cancer. It's always a fight. He was the greatest fighter. We learned so much from him. But we learn so much when we look at what the revolution in art was all about, where these guys discovered chiaroscuro, light and dark, mannerism. We discover perspective. Tell us some of the things that are special principles that the Renaissance artists brought to the world.
Yeah, well, what we have to remember is Renaissance is a word meaning a rebirth. And what these people were doing is they were looking back at the art form of the ancients, of the Romans and the Greeks. And if you look at Greek and Roman sculpture, and if you look at Greek and Roman painting, of which very little survives, but you see that they had also mastered perspective, and they had mastered realism and naturalism. And that just disappeared over the period ensuing the couple thousand years, or 1,500 or so, 1,200 years after the ancient time. It just disappeared into a new style that was more spiritual and more stylized. It was the Byzantine style. And so the Renaissance masters, basically the scholars of the day, looked back at that period in the art forms as these things were being unearthed in Italy in archaeological digs, and they saw the beauty and the naturalism, and they said, let's bring that back. So as they were exploring how to kind of copy the ancients and bring back these concepts, they were also pushing the envelope and making it even more realistic and more naturalistic than the ancients had. Hmm. And also in the culinary realm, they looked at recipes that survived from the ancient world, and they believed that they actually surpassed it with their own culinary arts.
Hmm.
So it was a return to a naturalism, but then, of course, they took it to new heights. Absolutely, spectacular heights.
I use an example of the challenge in this Teddy Atlas. I hope we find the soundbite. This Teddy Atlas describing Muhammad Ali like Raphael with the canvas. Literally, it is a canvas that the boxing ring is in, but that he was an artist. What I want you to teach us is, for me, the School of Athens by Raphael, made in 1510, it literally makes you feel like you're looking three-dimensionally down the corridor. Where in L.A. can we see a favorite of yours from the Renaissance that really shows that genius contribution from the Renaissance artists of perspective?
Oh, goodness. I wish we had the School of Athens. I mean, to compare that to anything we've got in Los Angeles is very difficult. But, let's see. Oh, gosh. You're talking about using the architectural perspective that he did.
Just the trick of fooling your eye into seeing.
The trick of fooling the eye. If you go into the Norton Simon or the Getty Center or a LACMA, you go into the paintings from the 1400s and 1500s, there are so many beautiful examples of this, of fooling the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm going to pull one out right now, Lorenzo Lotto. There's a Madonna and Child with two donors portrait at the Getty Center, where you really believe you're looking through a window at two real people. I mean, these people are so realistic looking. The man even has hair coming down the back of his neck and onto his back in his very simple tunic. And these people are bowing before a Madonna and Child who are somewhat stylized and very beautiful. Mm. But it's done in such a way that you feel like you almost know these people. And just behind them is there's a beautiful colonnade, an architectural setting, and just behind them in the open colonnade is a beautiful little landscape scene in the corner. Lorenzo Lotto was from the Veneto, so it's the type of scene that he would have looked out his window from his workshop and painted what he saw. And it's almost like the first indication that there's going to be landscape paintings that are pure landscape paintings coming after that. But if you were to look up right now on the internet, Getty Center, Lorenzo Lotto, this is a good example of the artist fooling you almost into believing you're looking through a space, into a space, and seeing real people. This is almost a snapshot of two real people. We don't know their names, but they're so believable. They're so realistic.
I love putting you on the spot because I always know you're like a cat because they don't have a collarbone. You could take a cat upside down an inch off the ground and let go and they land on their feet. Cats can jump out of buildings and never break anything because they have a sling. There's no collarbone to break. You're amazing because I can just put you on the spot and you have a painting. So here's another one. Leonardo da Vinci. He makes the Mona Lisa, a beautiful example of playing with light and dark and shading, chiaroscuro. Where in L.A. can we see your favorite, one of your favorites, Renaissance paintings where these masters bring to life light by showing shade and dark?
Well, I'm going to go a step beyond Renaissance on this because my new favorite painting in Los Angeles is actually a Baroque painting from early 1600s, but it is taking the lessons of chiaroscuro, that subtlety of light and dark, and making a dramatic contrast in the light and dark. And that's a brand new painting that just came into the Getty Collection. I'm so excited about it. And it's Danae, a painting of Danae, who is the young Greek woman whose father trapped her into a tower because an oracle told him that she was going to have a child that would eventually kill him. And so Jupiter comes to her in a shower of gold and seduces her in this tower. And a painting by Orazio Gentileschi that is just so beautiful, dates to 1621, of Danae receiving this shower of gold on this gorgeous bed. And here is where you see the chiaroscuro used to its most dramatic effect. Absolutely stunning painting. Life-size and just, so beautiful.
I'm going to put you on the spot again because this is really a lot of fun. I want to play a soundbite. It's about a minute and 16 seconds of Teddy Atlas, the boxing expert, describing the modern day, who just passed away, Muhammad Ali, a Renaissance man. Last night. Describing him and of the many great things Muhammad Ali brought us. But what Teddy Atlas focuses on in this soundbite is that because he made a mistake in the ring. He did it wrong. But because he did it wrong, he was so talented he could make it right. Where is there an example in art where we see that nobody else would do it this way, but this guy could do it and made it right? Listen to Teddy Atlas talk about Muhammad Ali.
He showed you that you could do things wrong in a ring. He was a pioneer. He was an innovator. In other words, he did so many things wrong in the ring, but he made them right. No, he made them right. I mean, he dropped his hands, he pulled back. The textbook says you slip punches, you don't pull back from them. You weave punches, you don't anticipate them and drop your hands and taunt a guy to throw at you and put your chin a millisecond away from a dangerous left hook and then make it miss by a milli-inch. You don't do that, but he did that. He showed you that he could take great talent and great belief, mix it together, and make a great portrait in the ring, a great painting, his own painting. I mean, we had Michelangelo, we had Rembrandt, we had all those different kinds of guys, but this was Ali doing his own strokes a whole different way, a way never seen before. Even the small guys that moved around with their legs, they didn't move around with their legs for 15 rounds. They didn't do it with their hands down. And again, they didn't do it with their chin perilously out there waiting to get touched. And then he didn't let you touch him. The only time you touched him when he was young was when the referee made you touch gloves at the beginning.
Think of that, Robin. He's pointing. First of all, I love that he mentions Michelangelo in this. And a canvas is a canvas. They're boxing on a canvas, but a painter paints on the canvas.
Right, that's perfect.
But where do you see the risk-taking? You're doing it wrong, but because they're so talented, they make it right. Where do we see that in L.A.?
It's listening to a different drummer, really. And you just made it complicated because you said, where in L.A. can you see this? I was going to talk about Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, which you can't see.
Well, you can talk about that. Why not?
Well, I'll talk about that. And actually, I'm going to end it up with, yes, you can see it in L.A. And here's the story. Leonardo, and I think like Muhammad Ali, was listening to a different drummer. Okay, there were rules. You're supposed to do it this way. He was pushing the envelope, and he was trying to find a better way to do a fresco. So he wasn't just doing it with the way that they did it, where you mixed in the pigment with the plaster and you put it on fresh. He didn't want it to be that fast drying. So he mixed oil in with the plaster because oil was the new binding agent that they were using for painting. And in the process of slowly creating this complete and utter masterpiece, which is the Last Supper in Milano, in the process of doing this, he created this new form of painting on a wall in fresco. However, it was a mistake because it didn't last. It started to flake away. Within his lifetime, it was already flaking away. But it was so magnificent that so many people were inspired by it, and so many people did drawings of it, and he did preparatory drawings. We can have an idea of what it looked like. It's been restored today. It's probably a shadow of what it used to be when it was originally made. But he was not following the rules the way it had been done before, because he was pushing the envelope to create something new and something more beautiful than had ever been created before on a wall. And that's really what he did with this painting.
Where do we see an artist in L.A. from the Renaissance that made mistakes, but because of their talent, super exceeded?
Well, the one that I was referring to earlier was Leonardo da Vinci, and everyone knows who he is. He is the quintessential Renaissance man. And I think kind of like Muhammad Ali, I think this is a great metaphor. I said before, he was listening to a different drummer. He was pushing the envelope. He was doing it his way, and he was trying to make improvements. He was trying to make painting better. Just like Muhammad Ali was showing that with his own intuition, he could make boxing better. He turned it into an art form. To watch him was like to watch a dancer. It was like poetry. It was beauty. It was art. And as I was saying before, when he painted The Last Supper, he was pushing the envelope. He was using different materials. He was trying to create something so beautiful. This moment when Christ tells his disciples that one of them is going to betray him, and all of them look to one another with their own individual personalities in shock, saying, well, how could this possibly be? So he takes all of these disciples, humanizes each one of them, has them have this very human reaction. And to paint this the way he wanted to, he had to do it slowly. He couldn't do it quickly in the usual fresco method. But the method that he used was not a method that was going to last. And he learned from this mistake that this really didn't work. People learned that this really didn't work. And so he ended up painting a masterpiece that many people were inspired by, but that deteriorated. And today, as I said, you can go and see it in a
like a Snapchat.
It's but it's not what it used to be. But right here in Los Angeles, we have an unbelievable resource, which is, believe it or not, Forest Lawn, the Memorial Park.
What?
In Glendale.
Really? I'm dying to get in there. No, okay.
This is a fascinating story, too, and I don't want to make it too long because I want to get back to the Renaissance. But the creator of this memorial park, Dr. Hubert Eaton, so loved beautiful Renaissance art and realized that in the 19-teens and 20s, very few people could go to Italy and see it in person. So he had lots of copies of Michelangelo statues made and brought to Forest Lawn. And he also commissioned a stained glass window of Leonardo's Last Supper. It was done in a workshop in Perugia by a woman, Rosa Moretti, who was part of this family workshop of stained glass artists. And she looked at Leonardo's original drawing. She looked at a lot of the copies of the paintings by other artists that were made of the Last Supper. And she created a stained glass version of it. It is just spectacular.
Wow!
And it's right here in Glendale.
Oh,
it's right here.
God.
Most people don't know about this, and it's so funny because Forest Lawn was the number one tourist destination in Los Angeles until 1955-56 when Disneyland opened. And then tourists went to Disneyland, and museums started to come along in Los Angeles, and people sort of forgot about Forest Lawn. But at any rate, that's another subject for maybe another talk.
They talk about an e-ticket. It's the eternity ticket when you go to Forest Lawn, right? The ultimate e-ticket.
It's pretty spectacular.
Thank you so much for waking up early to be with us yet again, Robin. We really love having you.
My pleasure.
Okay, great. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show on ESPN LA 710. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. I'm going to take your calls. Lots of clapper vision. But I want to talk about Muhammad Ali. If you've got a good Muhammad Ali story, by all means, call in. The number is 877-710-ESPN. And throughout the show, I'm going to pepper you with sayings that mean so much to me that I heard over the years. I met him actually once waiting for my luggage at the airport. He already had the Parkinson's pretty bad, but I just had to go up to him and shake his hand and say hello to him. And it's like shaking hands with Michelangelo for me. Here's one of my favorite. Silence is golden when you can't think of a good answer. That's pretty good advice from someone who could talk a lot. So I appreciate that. All right, let's hear it. Let's hear a Muhammad Ali story. Dorian in L.A., let's hear what you got to say about Muhammad Ali. Thanks for calling. You there, Dorian?
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Doing fine. Listening to all the stories, I was very pleased to hear, and I wanted to share mine. I live in L.A., and I remember one day around 1980, I was a kid, and Muhammad Ali actually used to work out a lot, and he used to go jogging. So he stayed in the area right around, it's called Hancock Park area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of it's a nicer area. And he would jog through the neighborhoods, even to the poorer areas of L.A. And I remember one day he was jogging down Western, and he ended up at a liquor store where he was kind of bombarded by a crowd. And he saw my sister getting into a car, and he's like, hey, can I ride with you? I'm trying to get out of here. And my sister said, I know who you are, but I don't really know you, and wasn't sure if she should, you know, let him in. But she ended up doing it anyway because it's the champ, you know. And the champ ended up driving with her a few blocks over to my parents' house, where she rung the doorbell and put a towel over his head and said, Dad, who do you think this is? And he said, Hey, Mr. Banks, I'm the greatest. And then my dad, of course, said, well, that's Muhammad Ali right there. And sure enough, it was. And he went inside our house and had a glass of lemonade and stayed for about 20 minutes before leaving. And before he left, he said, why don't you guys take me home? And my father and my sister and my brother took Muhammad Ali back to his house, where they stayed there for another 3 or 4 hours. Just talking with them and enjoying his company. And that's just a testimony to who he truly was, because his greatness and his niceness on and out of the boxing ring, even in his family. We went to school in L.A. I went to Fairfax. His daughter is more my age,
mm-hmm.
and I believe she went to university,
mm-hmm.
high school. And if you just were one of the kids in the know-who circle, you know, they would always give parties and invite all sorts of kids from the inner city, you know, to go out to their house to come sometimes on Fridays and Saturday nights to have a place to go to and dance and party. And that's what I really love and remember about Ali and his family. And I really appreciated you letting me share this story on the radio.
That's a beautiful story, Dorian. Thank you so much. Growing up in my house, he meant so much to my father and to me, because he stood up for his beliefs during the height of his career, when he could have won so many more belts and titles. He walked away because of his religious beliefs. And that meant the world to my father and to me that he felt that way. One of his quotes that really has lasted with me, he said, I don't count the sit-ups. I only start counting when it starts hurting, because they're the only ones that count. That's what makes you a champion. Be an individual. Stress yourself out to do more with your life. That's what Muhammad Ali meant to me and to all of us. What a special guy, and we're going to talk about him all day long, and thanks so much for sharing that. All right, let's go quickly. Let's take one more quick story. Steve from L.A., you're on with Dr. Clapper. How can I entertain us with a Muhammad Ali story?
Yes, Doc. I love your show.
Thank you.
First story, I met Muhammad Ali as a kid as a scout of the Harlem Globetrotters with a neighbor, and said, if you get to know me better, you'll meet some of the most fabulous people. Well, he was right. When I got to college and was a football player, I was pretty shredded. And a guy who had worked at Bank of America, me, I worked graveyard, said, mm-hmm. you know, you really ought to get into boxing. Which wasn't unusual for me, because when I was young, I never saw a fight I didn't like. And mm-hmm. he says, I know some Italian guys that will train you and pay you, and yeah, they were probably the mob, whatever. So I go to Pauley Pavilion, and Billy Preston was and his group, the Rhythm Rebellion. Billy went to Dorsey High a year before me, mm-hmm. was opening for Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And in the intermission, I see the champ, and I go by,
wow.
and I give him a hug. And, you know, we did the black handshake, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, Doc, I got to tell you, it was like he enveloped my hand
yep.
and it was like an anvil. And I knew then that if I were to get in the game, you don't want to go in just to be a punk drunk.
Right.
A punch drunk also ran. You would want to have to fight the best. And I knew that even with gloves on, those anvil, every time he punched me, it was going to be like taps. And you the know, other thing I wanted to say,
yeah.
Another thing, when later in life, he started the Muhammad Ali Amateur Sports. He sponsored track meets and mm-hmm. amateur boxing.
Wow.
And so I made a dear friend, his executive liaison. I met him. But anyway, at the Long Beach Arena, they were having the track meet. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to one of his people. And I said, you know, I'm trying to get, I've got Mayor Bradley involved. I would like to see Champ sign this proclamation to make Dr. King's birthday a national holiday. And could I announce it at the Long Beach Sports Arena? Ali agreed to it.
Wow.
I went in the middle of the infield and then near the shot put in the javelin. They stopped the show before the 100-yard dash and let me make an impassioned plea for people to sign a proclamation for Muhammad Ali. I mean, excuse me, a Dr. King national holiday. Now, what
happened? Steven, that is amazing. And what I love most about that story is the fact that just shaking his hand convinced you that you shouldn't get in the ring. And I got to tell you something. The very first time I watched Dr. Job do a surgery, it was like a rosebud, and the petals of the rose fell apart in his hand as he dissected through. These are the moments that make all the difference in our lives. For you, it was shaking his hand. For me, it was just standing next to him in the airport. All right, coming up next, I'm going to take more of your calls. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show, the Muhammad Ali and the Renaissance. You're listening to the Weekend Warrior Show. That's the great Roy Orbison. He writes this song, Only the Lonely. I mean, he's writing about miserable things, crying, only the lonely. He writes this song for Elvis and the Everly Brothers. They both turn him down. So he says, all right, I'm going to sing it.
Damn right.
That's right, Roy Orbison. And it became a big hit for him. Over and over again. He looks in the mirror as a kid. He sees this white blonde hair he has. He says, I hate the way I look. He was a little kid. He starts putting black dye in his hair. He was so shy, had stage fright, but he loved to sing. Once he got early in his career, he left his Coke bottle glasses. Everybody in the family had bad vision. He left the glasses on the airplane. He's got to see. He's going to go on stage. The only glasses he has that has a prescription are his sunglasses. He puts his sunglasses on, and he realizes, wow, I don't have stage fright. Meantime, everybody's going, look at that guy on stage with sunglasses on. This is way before Bono and everybody else. But it really helped him with his stage fright. Now they all thought he was a mysterious guy with black hair and sunglasses. Everything that was problematic in his life, he reversed. And he stuck with it. He's an amazing inspiration of going in reverse to become successful. Same thing for Jimmy Johnson. But what about you, the weekend warrior, and fitness and training? So Jared got on the phone and he tracked down a fitness expert, the well-respected Matt Fitzgerald. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be on the show.
It's our pleasure. We're talking about making success out of going in reverse. This week I did a shoulder surgery called a reverse shoulder replacement, which is the craziest thing you can imagine. As a surgeon, we're constantly trying in orthopedic surgery to fix things, to put things back together again the way they were, or even to reconstruct them if you've worn out a joint. But we're never taking something and make the ball into the socket and the socket into the ball. But that's actually the way you solve the problem when someone's rotator cuff cannot be fixed. This operation that comes from France that was ridiculed has now changed the world. But in training, Matt, running, this overuse syndrome, this repetitive nature, what a brilliant idea to be able to train by running in reverse. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so it sounds like an April Fool's gag, but it's actually, you know, running in reverse has been studied at places like the University of Milan, and it has some benefits for sure. It helps balance out the muscles. You know, when you're running forward all the time, you're always using the same muscles and sort of not using others. So
right.
If you just switch it up, go backwards, you start to balance things out a bit. It's also lower impact. So, you know, landing is hard when you move backwards. So it definitely does have some real benefits.
So tell us a little bit about you, Matt. Who are you? What did your dad do for a living? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Hampshire. I live in California now. My dad, I'm a chip off the old block. So when I was growing up, my dad worked as a writer and ran marathons. And now, you know, 30-some-odd years later, I run marathons, also coach runners, and I do quite a bit of writing as well about running and other fitness topics.
So you followed in your father's footsteps.
Sure did.
You know what? My dad was a carpenter, Matt. All I watch, as my mother, the nurse, used to say, he knocks nails for a living. That he's using his hammer and putting together roofs and kitchens and whatnot. And that's all I wanted to do was be like him, measure twice, cut once, and cut things up. And one day my mom said to me, so Robbie, what are you going to do with your life? I said, I'm going to be just like him. I want to be a carpenter. She says, are you crazy? He could barely make a living. Robbie, you should be a doctor. Then you could do whatever you want. So I became an orthopedic surgeon, which in essence, Matt, is like you. I became a carpenter in the body. I followed in my father's footsteps. So tell us the fascination you have with running. How do you train personally? What do you do to stay in shape?
Yeah, so, you know, even though I am a runner, I'm currently training for a 50-mile ultra marathon. So that's a very long run. But I mix up my training sort of for the same rationale that you might do some backward running, because running is hard on the body, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I run a few times a week, but I also lift weights, I bicycle, I do some steep uphill treadmill walking. I have a machine called an Elliptigo, which is like an outdoor elliptical trainer, an elliptical trainer on wheels. I swim occasionally. I find that mixing it up like that kind of keeps things fun, but also keeps my body healthy so that I can actually make it to the starting line of running events.
Tell us about your diet. First of all, how old are you?
I'm 44.
Tell us about your diet. What do you have for breakfast? Do you snack in between? Do you have lunch? Do you have something in the afternoon? Do you have dinner? What do you do Monday through Sunday?
So I have a pretty big interest in nutrition. I'm a certified sports nutritionist, and I spent the last year actually kind of traveling all around the world studying the diets of the most successful endurance athletes, and I kind of model my diet after them, and it's pretty simple. You know, if you look at Kenyan runners or Canadian cross-country skiers, they just eat a very high-quality version of a culturally normal diet. So, they eat like the people around them. It's just they're eating more whole grains and less sugar. So everything I eat looks pretty normal. You know, it's something like granola, low-sugar granola with berries for breakfast, coffee, orange juice. Lunch is usually, I work at home, so I often have dinner leftovers. My wife and I eat a lot of fish, a lot of whole grains like quinoa, a lot of steamed vegetables, things like that. I snack when I'm hungry. I don't when I'm not. Nuts are a favorite snack of mine. So pretty normal diet, but very high consistent quality standards for me.
Do you ever splurge? I mean, come on, you got to have a slice of pizza or some ice cream once in a while.
Oh, you bet I do. Yeah, like once a week, usually on Saturday. In fact, as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm going to do this. I'll go for like a big giant run or a bike ride. And when I come home from that, it's got to be pizza. I'm craving it. Got to have it. I've burned a lot of calories, so I feel like it's okay.
So you've written a book, Matt. I've written three books. Mine are all about hips and knees. What is your book about?
I've written a few as well, but the most recent one is called How Bad Do You Want It? And it's really about the psychology of endurance sports. Things like sports like running are very different on a psychological level from, games like basketball. Basketball is fun. Running's not. Even if you're good at it, even if you love it, it's not fun. And so you need sort of a very particular psychological approach to master the challenges of being an endurance athlete. So my book is intended to address that.
Interesting. So psychologically, Mark Spitz used to say the repetitive, awful nature of just swimming laps. He would imagine a naked woman was at the other end of the pool, so he would swim really fast to that end of the pool, and then boom, he'd have to do this all over again. It's like the goldfish in my lobby, in my waiting room in my office. Somebody once told me to a goldfish, they have a memory that only lasts 3 seconds, so when they get to the other end of the tank, they go, I'm in a new tank. What a new scenery. Boom, they go to the end, and there's a brand new tank again. If only we could live like this, that would be fantastic. So
that would be helpful to runners and swimmers.
So what do you think about while you're running? Give us a secret pearl from the book. What is it psychologically when you are doing something monotonous that you think about? For me, I'm a surfer. The most enjoyable part of surfing is everything. from even taking the board out of the back of my truck. I love it all, but waiting for the waves is really my time to meditate, and it's as important as when I stand on the wave. What is it for a runner? What's the stuff that you think about while you're doing this long-distance run?
It sort of depends. You know, when I'm doing sort of a long, low-intensity run, I will meditate as well. You know, people don't believe it, but I never get bored when I'm running. Because I'm a writer, I'll write in my head while I'm out there for hours running. When it's a more intense workout or a race, that's when you can't just let your mind wander anymore. You have to focus your thoughts because it helps you perform, just like, you know, just like your body helps, your thoughts can too. So you want to marshal them. And there's a variety of tactics that can work. For example, when you have a negative thought, like, oh boy, I'm feeling awful, I'm not going to make it to the finish line, you need to sort of step back from yourself and catch that thought early, push it out of your head, and replace it with a positive alternative, such as, you know what, I've been here before and it turned out okay in previous races. So just be patient, those types of things.
The tricks that you can play. I remember the great director Alfred Hitchcock was interviewed by Francois Truffaut, another director, in this amazing interview towards the end of Alfred Hitchcock's life. And Truffaut said to him, "So, Alfred, what's your favorite part of making the movie?" And you know what Hitchcock said? He said, "None of it." He goes, "What do you mean? You're Alfred Hitchcock. How could you say you don't enjoy being a movie director?" He said, "For me, it's when I read the treatment or read the book, I start, like you, Matt, in your head, I start putting the movie together. I put the scenes together in my head. Once it gets to make the movie, I've already made the movie. None of it is fun. I've already made the movie in my head." So to some extent, I think that that's probably the secret about the physical part of exercise is really the mental part. Matt, for sure, this is the reversal. It's the reverse of what you would think. It's not the physical part of exercise. It's the opportunity to mentally exercise is why you love to long distance run. Ha! That's fantastic. Maybe that's why I like surfing so much, Matt. Wow. So what's next for you? What are you up to?
Well, I've got that 50-mile run coming up. Pray for me. That's on April 2nd.
I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I will be at the finish line. I'm going to call you pre-op from now on, Matt.
Right. With pizza. Be waiting with pizza.
Now, when you land with each step, do you do heel strike, mid-stance, and then toe off? Or are you hitting on your toes? What is your technique for landing with each foot as your gait moves along on the race?
So for me, I am naturally sort of a mild heel striker, except, you know, when I'm running faster, I'll sort of move a little bit forward on my foot. That's just kind of, you know, the way I've always been. And it's not ideal, but it is natural. So I try to make up for that by, like I said, you know, cross-training with non-impact modalities, running on soft surfaces. But yeah, I'm not textbook in that regard.
Before I let you go, just last question. Tell us about injuries. Have you had any injuries or surgeries due to your exercise life?
You name it. That could be an all-day conversation. Yeah, I've had both knees operated on, and every overuse injury that's common to runners that you can name, had it. Yep.
Well, we will look forward to reading your book, Matt. I want to thank you for taking time to spend with us. We really appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay. The great Matt Fitzgerald. Warriors, coming up next, I'm going to tell you all the things that can happen to your body when you do run. Okay? It's called altacocoritis. We're going to get into that. The number I'll take your calls is 877-710-ESPN. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show. Love these guys. And I love the father, Vincent Laporcio. This is an L.A. thing. Speaking of non-L.A. things, I want to talk about ice cream. And then I'll take your calls. I grew up having ice cream in New York. The first man, 1939, to invent soft serve ice cream. Now you got frozen yogurt, which, by the way, don't get fooled. You know what's in that frozen yogurt? Sugar. Lots and lots of sugar. You want ice cream, soft serve ice cream. And how did this come about? Because the machine, his ice cream truck broke down in the summertime. When was it? It was 1934. Tom Carvel. And he pulled into a parking lot with the ice cream starting to melt. people were going crazy for the fact that it was almost melted ice cream. And he realized something's going on here. So he invented Tom Carvel. It's all over New York, but there's only one spot for Carvel ice cream in L.A. It's on Santa Monica Boulevard. It's like two blocks from the 405 freeway on Santa Monica Boulevard. Why do I love it so much? Because they have something called a brown bonnet. It's not cheap, but I just had it yesterday. It was like brought back memories, and you guys will enjoy this immensely. Tell Steve Winnick you heard this on the Weekend Warrior Show. They'll take the beautiful, soft vanilla ice cream on the cone, creamy. No, it's not sugar like frozen yogurt, but super creamy. And you tell him you want what Dr. Clapper likes, a brown bonnet. He takes the ice cream, just came out of the machine on the cone, and he turns it upside down into hot fudge sauce. You think, well, the ice cream's going to fall in. It doesn't. And then you pull it out right away. This freezing cold, creamy ice cream is now covered and immediately hardened this chocolate shell because the hot fudge meets the ice cold ice cream and hardens. I think one of the greatest things in the world to eat is that first bite of pizza where you eat the corner, right? Boom, you put it in your mouth. Forget the rest of the pizza. You hear that, Steve Cohn? You should just like they have those rib tips. You should just have pizza tips. That's all I want. The rest of the pizza I don't want. Just the tip of the pizza. But you eat the tip of that brown bonnet. Cost you like $5. But it is the greatest thing to put in your mouth. It melts immediately. The hard crack of the chocolate and the ice cold creamy ice cream that's underneath. It's like the greatest thing. Brown bonnet, you got to get one. Okay, let's go to Ryan in Malibu. You're on with Dr. Clapper. How can I help?
Hey, Dr. Clapper.
How are you?
I twisted my knee surfing the other day.
And, it was big. It was big in Malibu. I went Thursday afternoon. I saw patients in the morning. I said, I don't have a meeting this afternoon. I'm out of here. And I went up to Ventura, and I caught, oh, my God, glass off. It was fantastic. What day did you go surfing?
Thursday morning.
Oh, you got it in the morning. It was like 8 feet in Malibu, I heard.
Yeah, it was pretty big.
All right, so what happened to you?
Well, you know, my back leg slipped off the back of my surfboard, and I twisted my knee, and I feel like I sprained my MCL and even, like, pulled my hip flexor as well.
Hmm.
And it's pretty painful, and I just wanted to...
This is what you need to do, Ryan. You're very lucky, because if this turns out just to be your medial collateral ligament... You got to wear a brace. So go to Big Five. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but you need something with a little bit of a hinge. You can't just have a sleeve. You should have that, and you should wear that for at least a few weeks if it's just a mild sprain. Things take 6 weeks to heal. And get one waterproof so you can even continue to surf because the waves are great with the brace on. But here's the problem. That's the good news, that it's not like the ACL, which is bathed in joint fluid, so it will never heal. The medial collateral ligament can go on and heal on its own because it's just underneath the skin. The joint fluid doesn't poison it like the ACL will in terms of the healing. But what the deep portion of the medial collateral ligament is intimate with the root of the medial meniscus. So I see patients all the time. The medial collateral ligament has been torn. But if it starts to enter the medial meniscus, then you can have trouble. So let's hope you didn't do that. But if, God forbid, you were to now have a moment, either on the surfboard or walking, and your knee gives out on you, you will now tear your medial collateral ligament deeper and actually create a meniscus problem, and then you will need surgery. So right now, let's hope you got lucky. Stay away from Advil, Motrin, Aleve. They delay healing. And when you say, okay, Ryan, what can I do to heal fat? I hope you don't smoke cigarettes because that'll delay healing. But you want to, the one thing that I want you to do that will enhance healing, that's holistic, it's natural, is vitamin C. Not a pill, because you pee it right out. Naturally. What's naturally? Orange, citrus, but not a carton. Fresh oranges, grapefruits, kiwis, tomatoes, strawberries. The number one source, red bell peppers. What does vitamin C do? Ascorbic acid is the glue that holds collagen together. It's like the marinara. Here's a Clapper vision. It's like the marinara sauce and the collagen looks like the pasta.
Wow.
You get a thicker marinara sauce. That's what vitamin C is, and it glues the scar better and allows you to enhance the healing. So wear a brace, do lots of vitamin C. If it's painful, you can't surf, you can't do stuff. Let the pain speak to you about when you can get back into action.
Okay.
Then there's a book I wrote with Linda Yue called Heal Your Knees. Get a copy of the book. It'll make a great...
I read it. You fixed my ACL 10 years ago.
Oh, well, there you go.
That knee's working great.
All right. Well, tell your friends, Ryan. Thanks so much for that.
Thanks, Dr.
Okay,
Clapper.
God bless you. All right, let's take a break. Coming up next, I'm going to tell some stories. What I learned this week thinking about my guest at 8:15, who's going to talk about basketball players' hearts and why they die of sudden death like no other athlete. Because the heart is tall and big like a basketball player, but the valve is not. I want to talk about disproportion in art, making things bigger than they're supposed to be. Out of proportion, but in art. Those will be the stories. You'll hear them coming up next on the Weekend Warrior Show.